Hello and welcome to the Journeymen podcast. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all around the world.
We'll look at the club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes the platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations, and everything in between.
And here we are for our third episode, part one of our third episode. Last time round, we were talking about HSV, Hamburg Sportverein. We'd like to say a quick thank you to all the people who got in touch, the fellow Hamburg fans who gave us a lot of lively feedback. And apart from that, we'll be jumping into our third team around the globe.
Also, quickly, everyone who entered our Hamburg shirt giveaway as well. Thanks to everyone there.
It was really good. It was lovely to give out a beautiful Hamburg shirt from last year.
So now that brings us to the big reveal. Who are we going to be focusing on this week? Well, I think if you remember last time, the clue we gave you were that Hamburg faced off against this team in the 1983 UEFA Super Cup.
And that team was none other than Scottish Premier League team Aberdeen.
It was indeed, winning 2-0 against Hamburg.
However, Hamburg would get revenge 20 years later, maybe not so much properly revenge, in a friendly 3-2 to celebrate Aberdeen's centenary year in the March of 2003.
You can't call that revenge, I don't think.
Well, Aberdeen are known as either the Dons, the Dandies, or just simply the Reds.
You know, my traditional Pez link doesn't quite work that well with Aberdeen, sadly, because they've only been in Pez since 2019, and when they have, they've been licensed. So if you're a fan of Pez, it's Aberdeen FC.
Nice and simple, I guess. But as we like to do, just before we jump into the team, we give a little insight into what we knew about the team prior to jumping into the research and jumping through this podcast. I myself, as a Liverpool fan, was scorned by the likes of Sir Alex Ferguson, and I knew that he'd had a massive impact up in Aberdeen before moving to Manchester United. And usually that they were like the third, fourth, fifth best team in Scotland usually.
Yeah, and previously to this, like, the stuff I really knew, like, not a huge amount, like you say, I knew that, you know, Alex Ferguson had been here, got European glory with Strachan and McLeish, the likes of those players, and then probably nothing in between until more sort of recent times, seeing, like, Sonny Aluko and Adam Rooney scoring lots of goals. Not a great deal.
But one famous fan that I did manage to pick up on the way through this was the fact that groundskeeper Willie from The Simpsons, the animated TV show, is a fan of Aberdeen. So there's one famous fan for the Dons.
Nice. Indeed, there goes the final whistle. Aberdeen have won the European Cup Winners' Cup. And the celebrations now begin, both on the field and off. The referee, Benningale, stops the match. Aberdeen the winners by 2-1. A rousing performance by the Aberdeen side.
We like to sort of set the scene, do some location geography and then some football geography. So we'll go for the location geography first. So Aberdeen, if you're not too familiar with it, is a city in the northeast of Scotland. It's the third most populated city in Scotland after Edinburgh and Glasgow, of course. We're going from one port city to another. It's becoming like a journeyman, another journeyman tradition of only covering clubs around water. I'm not sure how that's happened, but yeah.
But with Aberdeen being based near the sea, they have a massive oil industry, making it one of the major ports in Northern Europe. Since the discovery of the North Sea oil in 1969, Aberdeen has been known as the offshore oil capital of Europe.
Yeah, and the city is wedged between the River Don and the River Dee, which is where the city gets its name, although I'm thinking immediately it should be called Dundee, but that's another place. And it translates to literally the mouth of the River Don from Gaelic. The Celtic word Abba means river mouth, so yeah.
Aberdeen is also known as the Granite City due to the large quarries dotted around the northeast of Scotland. More than 50% of Aberdeen's buildings are estimated to have come from one single quarry, the Rubishire Quarry.
I think even like the Houses of Parliament, docks in Southampton, Portsmouth and other buildings in Swindon and Leeds have all come from like quarries in Aberdeen.
So Aberdeen has really been a major part of building the UK, England and Scotland as a nation, you could definitely say.
Yeah, true. Aberdeen, like a lot of cities in Europe, has endured a lot through its time. You know, the Scottish War of Independence, where the Aberdeen Castle was destroyed, it's been rebuilt and extended, bent to the ground. Aberdeen was also plundered three times in the War of Three Kingdoms, obviously bubonic plague. More recent times, the Second World War, where it was attacked 32 times by the Luftwaffe. And we've not even got to the Scottish weather yet.
It definitely gives a new angle to the term the Granite City, because they've taken a lot of punishment by the sounds of it.
But it's stood strong, like Aberdeen granite.
Definitely. So from there, we move from the location of where Aberdeen is, up in the northeast of Scotland, to into some more juicy football geography and talk about the landscape of their rivals around Scotland.
Yeah, so they play their football at the Pittodrie Stadium, which holds about 20,000 people. And it's amazing when you actually look at the stadium how close it is to the sea. So it's only about 500 yards. And there's just a golf course in between the stadium and then the beach. So it's known as one of the coldest grounds in Britain, and I imagine very windy as well.
When we talk about some of the famous nights at Pittodrie, we'll be definitely mentioning the hailing wind in many of these videos and clips that we've managed to watch. You can see the baggy shirts of the players in the 80s just flapping in the wind as they play football at Pittodrie. But luckily as well, the stadium is used as a backup ground for the Scottish national team when redevelopment at Hampden Park has clashed with the fixture schedule. The first game being a 5-2 win versus Wales in the 3rd of February in the 1900s in a British home championship, which was an annual tournament of when the UK home nations would play each other. And the latest was a 1-0 loss to the Dutch in a friendly in November of 2017.
Actually, in 1978, it became the second all-seated stadium in Great Britain after the South Terrace had been fitted with bench-style seating. So we moved to local rival that they have, and Aberdeen don't really have like an immediate geographic rival. The closest like team is Cove Rangers, but they're in like the third tier of Scottish football and only actually got to the professional leagues in 2019. So it's not, you know, maybe in like 50 years' time, we could be looking back and talking about...
We could be doing an episode on Cove Rangers, maybe.
Who knows? So Aberdeen's more prominent rivalries have come from like battling for titles, trophies and stuff with other clubs further away in Scotland.
So of course in Scotland we have to mention the Old Firm, and we're going to be talking about the Blue Half first. They have a rivalry with Rangers, which emerged as and when Aberdeen became a force for Scottish football under Alex Ferguson during the 80s.
Some of the meetings that we've looked back on between these clubs, it's pretty intense. Yeah, blood and thunder doesn't cover it at all.
The first real animosity within this fixture can be probably traced back to a pair of shocking tackles that first came in a League Cup match between the pair in the 1980s. During the fixture, Willie Johnson, in fact, stamped on John McAster's neck at Ibrox. The foul was so bad that the Aberdeen midfielder was given CPR live on the pitch, and rightly, the opponent was sent off. It makes for some horrible viewing looking back now.
Even when Fergie left Scotland for Manchester United later on, things continued to boil over and heat up. Rangers began to reassert themselves, led by Graeme Souness, of all people, a very fire, combative player-manager. And there's sort of two major flashpoints. So in the 86-87 season, Rangers went to Aberdeen knowing that they would win the title with a game to spare if they won and Celtic slipped up at Falkirk. Souness saw red for two very strong tackles, put it lightly. A Terry Butcher header actually gave them the win, with Celtic losing to Falkirk. So the Rangers fans invaded the pitch to celebrate a 30th title on the Pittodrie pitch, which is, it's got to hurt.
So when you've got this rivalry brewing and you literally have to watch the opposition rival fans celebrating on your home pitch, I can't imagine anything does more to stoke the flames of this rivalry.
Yeah. A few years later, another thing to add to it, in the 88-89 season, a horrible tackle by Neil Simpson on Ian Durant would sort of cement it for forever, really. And the Aberdeen midfielder goes completely over the ball, stamps down on Durant's leg, and somehow Simpson remains on the pitch. Durant had to leave the pitch on the back of the physio because the medical service said the only stretcher like available was outside the ground and ambulance. So literally pick this guy up with this horrible injury and on his back and walk him off the pitch.
We'll make sure to add the snippet in later, but the commentator literally just proclaims, "He's being carried out on his back. I've never seen anything like this. It is genuinely horrific, horrific to watch."
Yeah, and Aberdeen actually gone to win that game 2-1. Rangers obviously aren't very happy about it, and skipper Terry Butcher was fined actually after the game for kicking a hole in the referee's dressing room door, with Souness unable to contain his anger.
You know it's bad when Souness can't even stop you from booting the ref's door in.
Do you reckon even in these days it was Paul Pogba's fault?
Even in more modern times, the fixture still features controversy. For example, on the final day of the 2008-09 season, Aberdeen faced off against Rangers at Ibrox. On the 35th minute, Aberdeen defender Charlie McGrew and Rangers Kyle Lafferty would clatter into one another on a challenge near the touchline. Both players squared up to one another, and then Lafferty collapsed the floor holding his face.
Yeah, it's a pretty pathetic dart. Like, it wouldn't look out of place at the Olympics kind of thing. And you'll recognise it from blooper reels and Soccer AM videos and stuff at the time. It was pretty bad. The referee brandishes a red card for Mulgrew as Lafferty then winks to his teammates as the defender walks off, so sealing like this hatred even more.
It's a little bit different from clattering tackles. It's a bit more modern, but yeah, it's definitely equally as devilish from the Rangers players. And since the 1975-76 season, they've played together 190 times, with Aberdeen winning 55, Rangers unfortunately winning 90, and they've drawn 45 times altogether as well.
Yeah, that brings us to sort of the next rival, the new firm. Not the old firm, the new firm. And this was a term first coined in the 80s to describe the fixture between Aberdeen and Dundee United, mainly because they were the third and fourth most popular cities and were the two most successful teams outside the old firm in the 80s.
Although not a traditional derby, with 65 miles separating both teams, the fixture was seen as a North-East Scotland derby. However, Dundee do share a more traditional rivalry with their very, very close neighbours, Dundee FC. There's literally one street separating both stadiums. Incredible.
That's a proper derby. Yeah, and like I say, like in the 80s, Aberdeen and Dundee were more than a match for the old firm, often winning trophies and things and always battling for titles. But with both teams, you know, stalwart to the Scottish game, they faced off 239 times. Aberdeen have won 96 of those games and Dundee United winning 76. However, Dundee have won the most high profile of their meetings, winning the 1979 Scottish League Cup final, which we definitely will come back to soon.
During Aberdeen's most successful period, Dundee United manager Jim McLean was hell-bent on emulating and exceeding Sir Alex Ferguson's achievements, particularly in Europe.
To be fair to him, Dundee runners-up of the UEFA Cup in 86-87 and Euro Cup semi-finalists 83-84, so not quite Ferguson levels, but he gave it a good go.
For one of the few teams outside of the old firm, yeah, he gave it a real go. David Bowman, former Dundee United player, now coach, states Aberdeen were the benchmark. With the new firm at the time, the two of us were competing against one another.
The rivalry didn't just stay like on the pitch between the 11 players on both teams. Fergie and McLean actually took part in regular five-a-side tournaments, along with like their support staff, assistant managers, coaches, whatever. And due to Ferguson's competitive nature, apparently games would turn into like the next goal wins, and it's two legs and stuff. So
classic five-a-side behaviour, I think, there, to be fair.
I wouldn't be surprised if Fergie was like the guy where it's like, you know, it's my ball, my rules kind of thing. Oh, my tea's ready, I'm taking the ball home. Like.
However, in more modern times, the Aberdeen new firm tag has kind of faded in importance, with both teams kind of falling away from the big high points of the 1980s.
It's only natural, really. It was born out of two teams competing for success, and now they're not competing for trophies regularly. It probably makes sense.
A more modern perspective on this is David Priest, former Aberdeen keeper. He even states that it's time to get rid of the new firm tag. It's something that was only relevant before my time.
Yeah, and that sort of brings us to the third rivalry, the North Derby, which is Aberdeen versus Inverness Caledonian Thistle. And the North Derby is sort of used to emphasise the relative geographical proximity, but the two cities are over 100 miles apart, but they are both in the north, basically.
The clubs first met in the Scottish League Cup tie played in the August of 1998. Inverness first entered the Scottish Football League in 1994 alongside fellow Highland side Ross County, forming the Highland Derby. However, Inverness progressed over the next 10 years to form a rivalry with Aberdeen after winning promotion to the top tier in 2004.
At one point, due to the redevelopment of the Caledonian Stadium to meet the sort of SPL standards, Inverness actually shared the Pittodrie Stadium with Aberdeen during the first half of the 04-05 season. So literally sharing the ground with a team that's sort of a rival. So pretty intense.
However, their most fierce meeting comes in the 2014 Scottish League Cup final. That's by far their most high-profile game too, and we'll be coming back to that. Don't you worry.
Getting it away in the thick of things. Gerrant going down. The Simpson went right over that one. And Rangers players incensed by that challenge as Simpson went right over the ball there. And one or two tempers just needing to be calmed down there. The referee will take action. And Ian Gerrant is being carried off.
It's a good time to launch in the sort of the early beginnings, early days of Aberdeen FC as we know them today.
Where did Aberdeen come from? Tell me, Mark.
Obviously, it's now a sort of recurring thing we find when we look into how these clubs begin, and it's usually three or four clubs in the city sort of merge to make one bigger club, and Aberdeen is no exception to that. So there was a precursor, Aberdeen Football Club, Victoria United and Orion, who merged together in 1903. But an interesting little side story related to Orion, one of the founding clubs. In 1885, so a few years before, the Scottish Cup, it was like an invitation tournament at the time, a team called Bonacord FC were mistakenly invited to compete in the Scottish Cup instead of Orion. And I'm presuming there was just some kind of like amateur group, and this envelope dropped through inviting them to play in the Scottish League, the League Cup, and so they loved it. And they went on to lose 36-0, which is a world record football score, which still stands today, with centre-forward John Petrie scoring 13 goals, which is a Scottish Cup and a joint world record. And I just feel sorry for the Bonacord goalkeeper. I felt like I wanted to give him a shout-out. Andrew Lawney, poor guy, conceded 36 goals.
Don't know how he got through it. However, Aberdeen and Victoria at the time both played in blue, while Orion played in a dark burgundy with blue shorts. The new club played its first match in the August of 1903, a 1-1 draw with Stenhouse Muir.
That first season actually produced a win in the Aberdeenshire Cup, but only a third place finish in the Northern League. The club actually applied for membership of the Scottish League for the following season, but were elected to the second division.
Manager at the time, Jimmy Phillip, was dispatched to Glasgow to make the club's case for being in the top tier, and returned with the promise of enough support from the decision makers. However, when the final decision was made, they were put in the second tier.
Jimmy Phillip, what a guy. He was actually in charge of the club basically from it beginning, the foundation in 1903, until he retired in 1924. And he's a born and bred Aberdonian. And he had a wide range of sporting interests. And he even paid for the first ever overseas tour by the Scottish international team, which is pretty cool. And randomly was a qualified referee and served as a referee at the Olympic Games in Stockholm.
At the end of the club's first season, despite having finished 7th out of 12 teams, Aberdeen were now elected to join the new and expanded First Division. They remained in the top tier of Scottish football ever since.
We'll come back to that statement, because there's a few times that they've just managed to survive.
Very big Hamburg vibes with Aberdeen in this one as well.
From 1906 onwards, the club made sort of steady progress, had a Scottish Cup semi-final appearance in 1908, another in 1911, where they actually lost to Celtic. And the strength of that team at the end of that season led to an invitation of a close season tour of Bohemia, Moravia and Poland, which is modern day Czech Republic, although it sounds like something out of like some Disney princess film or something, the Kingdom of Bohemia.
In the 1910-11 season, Aberdeen recorded their first victories over the old firm duo Celtic and Rangers, and led the league for the first time ever, but unfortunately finished second when it came to the very end of the season.
Over the next few years, they did seem to be sort of genuine contenders for the league title, topping the table a few times, but just sadly never at the end of the season.
Never quite having that conviction to get over the line. Unfortunately, wartime affected the club as the same as many others around the country. Despite spending cuts by 1917, the club's situation had become untenable. The manager and the players struggled on through the early years of the war, and the team often was made up of local servicemen. But by early 1917, the strain on the finances and the lack of public enthusiasm was just too much for the club to bear.
Yeah, they actually dropped out of competitive football along with Dundee and Raith Rovers. So after the war and the resumption of football in 1919, Phillip was offered his old full-time job back, a salary of £350 per year, and a move at the time which caused quite a lot of controversy among the directors at the time, him going back onto his pre-war salary.
Kind of crazy to think when you think of millions being spent on the wages of many players and managers around European top football now. So I'd say, go on, Phillip, get your money every year.
Well, he did. He accepted and prepared to take the club forward into the new decade.
Aberdeen resumed with a fixture against Albion Rovers, and Phillip continued to oversee a team capable of isolated good results but never quite being able to sustain a long challenge enough over a season.
The early 20s really was no more fruitful for him and Aberdeen than the pre-war era. But one record that was set that still stands of 2021 is Aberdeen's record victory of 13-0 over Peterhead in 1923.
Massive scoreline. There were also two further unsuccessful cup semi-finals in 1922 and in 1924, but Phillip's reign came to an end with no senior silverware to show for it.
It's quite sad because he's a local guy, loves his football, obviously, and has led them ably, like, to challenge for things, but never got a trophy or a medal or anything, which is quite sad.
And we'd even take a turn for the worst. As Philip continued to be involved with the club, he went to meet the Aberdeen reserve team on their return from Paisley on a Saturday evening, and on the return home had a fatal seizure believed to be related to a road accident he had been involved in 3 months prior in Ireland, strangely enough.
Yeah, and there was a massive attendance at his funeral in October 1930 in Aberdeen. The funeral cortege was over 3/4 of a mile in length and passed through the streets like full of spectators and Aberdeen fans.
You could tell he must have been a real man of the people. A lot of the people within Aberdeen must have seen a lot of themselves through him, of how he guided this team in the early days of Aberdeen. However, Philip would be replaced as manager by Paddy Travers. He presided over the team's first Scottish Cup final in 1937 on a more positive note.
Yeah, and he had some interesting backroom staff, as we would call him now, in his trainer, first team coach, basically, you know, in modern terms, was a former player called Donald Coleman. Quite an interesting little random fact is Donald Coleman, actually, he conceived the dugout, a covered area set slightly below the level of the playing surface to better aid the observations of the managerial team. And this guy basically invented it in Aberdeen in the 30s. And Everton visited Pittodrie soon after it had been introduced and exported the idea to the English League. And from there, it spread through the rest of the football world.
It's mad to think a little change in the scenery at Pittodrie would be exported all over world football and just become the norm as we take for granted now.
I love the idea of like Everton and Aberdeen fans fighting over who introduced the dugout first.
However, Travers left to become manager of Clyde in 1939.
And he was replaced by former Yeovil Town manager Dave Halliday. And he's one of more of 100 applicants for the role, and he's a very interesting character who has a ridiculous amount of records. And he's one of those where it's like, how have we never heard of this guy? And I think it's great that we find these characters and shed some light on them, I think.
So Mark's going to quickly fire through these, but buckle up. There is an absolute shed ton of records and things that he's absolutely smashed.
A lot of records. So let's start off. He's one of the most recent of only two players to be outright top goal scorer in both the Scottish and English top divisions. So that was with 38 goals for Dundee in 23-24 and 43 goals in a season for Sunderland in 28-29. He is the quickest player in history to 100 goals in English football's top division, taking 101 games to get to 100 goals, also at Sunderland, which is just mental. He's the only player to score 30 or more goals in 4 consecutive seasons in the English top division, which was achieved at Sunderland. No, like, Harry Kane's not done that. Like, crazy. He's scored at least 35 goals in each of those 4 seasons. It probably isn't much of a surprise, this one. He's Sunderland's most prolific goals-per-game striker, with 165 goals in 175 games. And his 211 goals in English football's top division with Sunderland, Arsenal, Man City ranks him as the 19th highest scorer of that level. And of the 27 players to have scored 200 or more goals in English football's top division, only Dixie Dean has scored at a more prolific rate. And to put that in like a world context, he's 54th in the world with 303 goals in 396 games in Scotland and England. And only 4 players have since exceeded his top flight goal tally. And 2 of them, Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. So it's quite good company to be keeping.
It's mad to think of when you put it into more modern perspective. Every week we like watching the likes of Mohamed Salah, Lukaku, Harry Kane, Erling Haaland, Lewandowski, all over Europe, smashing goals in for their clubs. And some of them are not even close to Dave here. So it's mad. Sunderland fans, get in touch if you've got any more interesting tales about him, because he must be a stone cold legend for Sunderland, surely.
Got to be. But that was his playing career, and now he's here as manager at Aberdeen.
Around this time, the club moved from their black and gold strip to the now what we know as the red and white strip.
Halliday had sort of barely begun his job, similar to the last manager as well. He starts working there and is another world war. So obviously halts competitive football in the UK and across Europe. For these 6 years, the club was temporarily taken over by the directors while Halliday actually went away and served in the war.
Halliday's place in the Aberdeen Hall of Fame was secured after the war when he became the first manager to bring national trophies to Pittodrie. Aberdeen won the Southern League Cup in the 1945-46 season, beating Rangers 3-2 at Hampden in front of a crowd of 135,000 people. Amazing.
45-46 Southern League Cup was actually the sixth and final edition of this regional wartime tournament. But the one sad thing is, even though this was the last edition of the competition, the trophy itself was used again for the 1946 Victory Cup, which was only played a few weeks later. I'm guessing the SPL were short on a bit of money after the war, like everyone, so they reused this trophy, which was won by Rangers in the Victory Cup. So therefore, Aberdeen win their first trophy, but only get to keep it for like a week, 2 weeks or something.
Clearly, the Scottish government were running out of metal from all the planes and bombs they'd been making, so they had to reuse the trophy, probably. What a shame for Aberdeen, though.
They would go on to reach the 1947 Scottish Cup final, defeating Hibernian 2-1, with George Hamilton, signed from Halliday's former club, Queen of the South, scoring to gain the club's first major trophy.
Pushing on from this early success, Dave Halliday's side reached two more Scottish Cup finals in 1953 and 1954. However, they did lose both.
Bigger things were cooking in there. 1954-55, Aberdeen win their first Scottish League title under Halliday. Even though they were league winners, the club didn't actually get to participate in the first ever European Cup, because Scotland's place was awarded to Hibernian, who took part by special invitation.
This special invitation came from the sports magazine L'Equipe in France, as this was the initial first ever European Cup tournament, and they were just inviting one team from as many nations as possible. And luckily for Hibernian, they were chosen from Scotland. I don't know why they overlooked Celtic and Rangers, because they were still the powerhouses of Scotland. Even then,
you've got a feel for Aberdeen. Like, they had their first ever trophy took off them after 2 weeks, and then they win the league, and you know getting excited, you might be playing European football, and then they invite a team that finished fifth. So, yeah, it's been pretty gutting.
Celtic actually beat Aberdeen on both occasions during the season, losing 2-0 and losing 2-1, while Rangers triumph once. Aberdeen, however, did hammer them in the home fixture at Pádraig 4-0.
You know, one thing that stands out to me is just poor Stirling Albion at the foot of the table in 16th, who had 2 wins from 30 and only 2 draws as well, so lost 26 games, scored 29 goals, but conceded 105 to give them a goal difference of minus 76. And you know what the best thing is? They didn't get relegated, because the division was being increased to 18 teams. So very lucky Stirling Albion got to stay in the division with that record.
It just reminds me of that Simpsons meme where it's like, stop, stop, he's already dead. It's just like, poor Stirling Albion. Do you think they just wanted a break and maybe to win some games in the division down below? And the SPL were just like, nope, you're staying up here and you're getting an extra beating for the next 12 months.
This complete punchback. But Paddy Buckley was the goal scorer for Aberdeen in this title winning season. He got 17 league goals, actually 29 in all competitions. And he'd actually joined Aberdeen for £7,500 2 years earlier in 1952.
What I could imagine as being a massive record-breaking transfer at the time. He did help them to the league championship in the 1954-55 season and the League Cup success in 1955. He also played in 2 Scottish Cup finals, the ones in 53 and 54. However, he would retire after a serious knee injury in 57.
Manager Halliday, talk about leaving on a high. So at the end of that championship winning season, off he goes, and he's replaced by Davy Shaw.
As mentioned, Aberdeen would win the 1955 League Cup under his guidance, beating St Mirren 2-1 at Hampden and finishing second in the league, runners-up to none other than Rangers.
It's the rivalry early forming there. In the League Cup final, Graham Leggett scored the winning goal for Aberdeen and scored 29 during that season. And he actually would later move to Fulham in 1958 for £16,000. And he actually held the record for the fastest hat-trick in the English league, scoring 3 goals in 3 minutes in a 10-1 win against Ipswich Town in 1963. This record was broken in May 2015 by Sadio Mane of Southampton.
Really bringing it up there to the modern context. But despite this initial success back at Aberdeen, Shaw would step aside for another former favourite player. Tommy Pearson, in 1959, joined Aberdeen. His time in charge coincided with the high turnover of players and yielded next to no trophies. He then retired in 1965 and made way for Eddie Turnbull.
Turnbull would lead Aberdeen to the 67 Scottish Cup final, where the side was defeated 2-0 by legendary manager Jochstein's Celtic.
Interestingly, Aberdeen fielded the only non-Scottish player during this game, Danish international Jens Petersen. He arrived at Pádraig from the Danish club Elsberg, where he had played as an amateur and initially struggled to make an impact in Scotland. After new boss Eddie Turnbull took over, Petersen began to make his mark at Pádraig, and Jens developed into a top draw defender. And after the 1967 Cup final, he was appointed as club captain for the following season. What a turnaround.
Despite the loss in the cup final, Aberdeen would qualify for the European Cup Winners' Cup in the following season, thanks to their appearance, because I think Celtic obviously had already qualified from winning the league. So finally, they're going to get some European football for the first time.
Those fans on those European away days for the first time.
Well, I mean, what a great first tie. So they beat, on aggregate, KR Reykjavik 14-1. Although they would lose the second round, sadly, against Standard Liège 3-2 on aggregate. But to win your first European game 14-1 on aggregate is still quite an occasion.
What an introduction. And an away day to Iceland, which personally I wouldn't complain at. So, eh. And then losing to Standard Liège in Belgium. Well, go and get some nice waffles to deal with the loss on aggregate, unfortunately.
I'm sure they had plenty of the nice Belgian beer as well.
2 years later, Aberdeen reached the Scottish Cup final again, and this time it proved to be more successful.
Yeah, and the star of this run to the Scottish Cup final, of course, is Aberdeen's Derek Cuptie Mackay, who actually recorded the only 4 goals of his Aberdeen career to help the team win the 69-70 Scottish Cup. And he scored the winning goals in the quarterfinal, semi-final, and 2 in the final itself. And prior to this, he'd actually only scored 1 league goal in his whole career. But sadly, he would leave Pittodrie just 3 matches after the final with a row over bonuses. But talk about important time to score the goals in your career. It's pretty impressive.
In the final, Celtic were once again the opponents, and this time Aberdeen recorded a 3-1 victory. Derek Mackay's 2 crucial goals came in the 83rd and the 90th minute to win it for Aberdeen.
Think of the drama. So, like, Aberdeen are 1-0 up after 27 minutes and go 2-0, 83 minutes. Celtic score 89, and then Derek Cuptie Mackay is there again to silence the Celtic fans 90th minute.
I can only imagine for those Aberdeen fans that encapsulating, you know you've won it now, 90th minute. 3-1, here we go. We've beaten our old rival in Celtic. What a feeling it must have been to be in the stands that day.
But in the very last minute, Mackay whipped in Aberdeen's 3rd goal. A 3-1 victory. Celtic had hoped to add the cup to their Scottish League and Scottish League Cup triumphs. It was a remarkable but well-deserved victory for Aberdeen.
Yeah, and as Scottish Cup holders, Aberdeen once again qualified for the same European competition, but were eliminated in the first round this time following a 4-4 aggregate tie with Honved from Hungary.
This tie was incredibly unique, seeing as the game finished level after extra time, and it was also level on away goals, so it was decided by the first ever penalty shootout in UEFA competition history. But unfortunately, Honved won the shootout 5-4.
The Aberdeen side of the 70s would regularly challenge for domestic honours, but would rarely win the trophies, with the exception of one competition, the Dryburgh Cup in 1971 and the League Cup in 1976, both against Celtic and both ended 2-1 to Aberdeen.
So now to give a little context on what the Dryburgh Cup was. It basically was a tournament set up by the brewery, the Dryburgh Brewery, to get around the rules about naming a Scottish footballing competition, which the Scottish FA wouldn't allow. So, yep, they just set up their own tournament and just went, well, we will do this anyway.
Fair play to them, you know. It's like the Emirates Trophy vibe to it.
Or the Audi Cup. This tournament was a straight knockout tournament open to the top 8 scoring teams in the Scottish League. 4 coming from the top division and 4 from the second.
You can just tell, like, the brewery, just they want to sell lots of beer and get everyone really excited. So it's inviting the top scoring teams and also doing some really random experiments with, like, rules and stuff. And, like, one example is the penalty area line actually extended to join up with the touch lines, creating like a solid line across the pitch 18 yards away from goal. And the offside law only applied when the player was beyond that new penalty area line. And the idea was to try and like encourage more attacking play in the opposition's half.
The effect was reduction in like midfield congestion, with attacking players being able to receive the ball higher at the pitch and the defensive lines being forced to drop deeper. However, at the time, Rangers boss Willie Maddle envisioned the problem that ended up coming true. He stated, it would ruin the game because it would take midfield play out of the game. People would just hit long balls forward to players who just couldn't be offside. So it was a nice attempt, a nice idea, but yeah, it would just be a goal hanger pretty much.
It sounds absolutely mental, to be honest. I'm glad the Dryburgh experiments didn't make it any further to like other football.
Hey, maybe when you're pissed in the stands watching this, maybe it's a bit more fun, but I'm happy that like Champions League doesn't settled like this.
I'm sure it sold beer.
However, during this decade, Aberdeen had 5 managers, as we've mentioned. Eddie Turnbull, Jimmy Bonthrone, Ali McLeod, Billy McNeil, and who we are going to jump into next, Mark?
Alex Ferguson.
We're watching the referee. And there it goes, the final whistle. Aberdeen have won the 1986 Scottish Cup final. And Alec Ferguson comes down from the stand to meet one of his old Ibrox buddies, Alec McDonald. But there, the triumphant manager, Alec Ferguson.
Ferguson would join Aberdeen as manager in June of 1978, and it would be only his third managerial job.
He started at East Stirlingshire at the young age of 32, and this was a team, when he took over, didn't even have a registered goalkeeper at the time. But by the 4th of October, Ferguson had already been invited to manage St Mirren. St Mirren were actually below East Stirlingshire in the league, but they were a bigger club. Fergie felt some loyalty to them, but he decided to go for it and take the St Mirren job after some advice from Jock Stein.
Ferguson was the manager of St Mirren from 1974 until 1978. He would produce a remarkable transformation of the team in the lower half of the old second division, watched by crowds of just over 1,000, and taking them to be first division champions in 1977. Incredible.
Absolutely incredible. An amazing turnaround of taking over a team down at the bottom of the league and taking them to the champions of the first division in just a couple of years. It's crazy, crazy. His St Mirren team won the title playing superb, like, attacking football, which is something obviously we'd all grow accustomed to later on at Manchester United. But the average age of his league winning team was just 19, and the captain, Tony Fitzpatrick, was only 20 years old.
So when Alan Hansen would unfortunately say those uttered words on Match of the Day with "you can't win anything with kids" about his Man United team, well, Sir Alex Ferguson had proved up in Scotland, you bloody well can.
Should have done his research. He looks even more stupid now we know this. Yeah.
But St Mirren do have the unique distinction of being the only club to ever sack Ferguson.
This was a breach of contract relating to him talking to Aberdeen and agreeing to join, but also trying to take some of his staff and players with him. So, you know, fair enough.
Ferguson had already turned down the Aberdeen job as well in 1977, with the role going to Billy McNeil. He, however, returned to Celtic after only 1 year, leaving the role available back for Sir Alex Ferguson once again.
His time in Aberdeen allowed him to sort of shape his philosophies, some great scouting. They had some really good young players coming through, like from the academy. He seriously challenged the status of the traditional old firm and established Aberdeen as the best side in the country.
Although Aberdeen were one of Scotland's major clubs, they'd only won the league once, the 55 title, under Dave Halliday. The team had played well and had not lost a league match since the previous December, having finished second in the league the previous season.
Ferguson had only been a manager for 4 years. He's not actually that much older than most of his players, and I think initially at Aberdeen he maybe had the trouble of winning them round and getting the respect of some of the older players in the dressing room.
Fergie's first season at Aberdeen wasn't especially amazing, but they would reach the semi-final of the Scottish Cup and reach the final of the Scottish League Cup, but losing both matches and would only finish fourth in the league. Fergie stated at the time, "It was a year of assessment. I don't think you want to do anything too drastic throughout the season," but they went ahead and increased the youth and schoolboy training, plus they added more scouts, and this was setting the foundation of what was to come.
The following season, they actually start off quite slowly in 79-80, losing three of their first six games, also suffer an early exit from Europe, where they were drawn against Eintracht Frankfurt and lost 2-1 on aggregate over two legs in the first round. But the form would improve dramatically, like, in the new year, and they would only lose one game of their last 20 matches.
Fergie speaks about the game that turned this season around. It was on a Saturday versus Morton, he speaks about. "It looked like the game should never have gone ahead, but they managed to get all the players, the kids, some fans to help push the snow off the pitch and get the game going. They won 1-0, and they just never looked back from there. Didn't lose a game for the rest of the season."
Yeah, and by the end of that season, after going on that crazy run after the snow clearance, they'd win the Scottish League, sealing it in style with a 5-0 win away against Hibs. And this was the first time in 15 years the league hadn't been won by either Rangers or Celtic.
Fergie was interviewed on the pitch, and you can tell he was so chuffed with how they had won the final game. They'd gone all the way to the end and won 5-0. He states, "It was my first piece of real success. You can only really attribute success to that type of victory, a 5-0 win at Easterhead, which is Hibernian's ground, and you just couldn't do better than that," he stated.
You know, a lot of the players from that time talk about how he installed like a us against the world kind of mentality, claiming like the media favoured the two big Glasgow teams. And he told his players to go to places like Ibrox, like Celtic Park, like Easter Road, and prove everyone wrong, and seriously did that this season.
After beating Rangers 1-0 early in the season, Fergie said that's when the players believed, OK, let's go and get Celtic.
After they win the league, this is like we spoke earlier when they're saying like maybe some of the players, the older players, are a bit unsure about him, and this is the thing where he gets the respect of the players. That's the achievement that united the dressing room, and they all were believing in him.
Aberdeen would pip Celtic to the title by one singular point, and they would have a great record against the Old Firm teams that season. It was key to winning the title, as they beat Celtic twice, drawn with them once, did lose one, but however they went completely unbeaten against Rangers, winning three and drawing one.
You look at their stats from that season, they're scoring 68 goals, only conceded 36, gives them a really good plus 32 goal difference and qualification for the European Cup.
Fergie stated about that season, the only thing that mattered was about beating Rangers and Celtic, because if you don't beat them, you're not winning the league. It's simple as that.
The guy that would fire them to the league and in those games against the Old Firm teams is Steve Archibald, and he scored 22 goals that season. That's actually one of four players that made into double figures. But Archibald would have a ridiculous career, and he'd actually leave Aberdeen straight after the title win to go to Spurs, and they paid $800,000 for him, which a lot of money at that time. And in his first season at Spurs, he finished the top goal scorer in the first division and won the FA Cup. Second FA Cup in 1982, and wins a UEFA Cup in 1984. Like, for Spurs fans, this is crazy. All these trophies. He even scored his penalty in the final as Spurs beat Anderlecht in the shootout. And after this, he then goes to Barcelona for just over £1 million. In his first season in La Liga, he helps them win the title for the first time in 11 years.
He seems to be the talisman for all these teams, and he was a popular figure at the Nou Camp, obviously, until restrictions about fielding foreign players led him to being excluded from the squad in favour of, to be fair, Gary Lineker and Mark Hughes. So that's some pretty stellar competition to be going up against. Sorry, Archibald.
Yeah, you know, once again, not bad company to be keeping, is it?
However, back with Aberdeen, four other players would also get double figures in that first title-winning season. Gordon Strachan would get 15, Drew Jarvey would get 14, and Mark McGee would get 10. Mark McGee, funny enough, links us back to Hamburg, as he would leave after that season to move to Hamburg.
I'm gutted we missed that before, and that would have been an even more obscure link.
Even less people would have gotten it.
Scanlon, yes! What a marvellous goal to finish this match. They have won. Alex Ferguson is on now in the penalty area. That is it. Aberdeen have definitely won the championship. Can you blame the man for going out of his mind temporarily?
So despite the Aberdeen players claiming a league title, they would actually miss out on a chance to be in an absolute classic film, Escape to Victory. You know, you can't have everything, can you?
They might have the medals, but they won't have the, you know, the box office success.
The Oscars.
Alex McLeish, Willie Miller, Gordon Strachan and Steve Archibald were all in the Scottish squad that embarked on an end-of-season trip to Hungary and Poland.
Jock Stein had said to the players that if any of them wanted to stay on after the tour and sort of be extras in the film, in Escape to Victory, because they needed people for the football scenes, they needed extras, they needed like doubles for the actors who couldn't really play football that well. People like Michael Caine and stuff. It was like crazy cast in this film. And, you know, the players that were there, you've got Pelé, Ozzy Ardiles, Bobby Moore, Mike Summerby. And sadly, none of the Aberdeen players made it to the film. McLeish, actually, because he just started seeing his now wife, had went home to see her instead. And I think every time he sees that film, he's pretty gutted and said he wonders if it could have been enhanced by the appearance of a certain red-headed Scotsman.
However, another non-footballing superstar in this film was Sylvester Stallone. He was famous at that point thanks to the success of the Rocky boxing films. But he did make a series of outlandish demands, such as wanting to score the film's game-winning goal, despite the fact that his character played in goal. So maybe not the smartest cookie, maybe took a couple of blows to the head playing that Rocky character.
All of the extras are actually Ipswich Town players, so just to rub it in even more.
Fortunate for Aberdeen. However, Sylvester Stallone probably didn't have as much of a punch as Fergie, because at that point he was a strict disciplinarian back in Aberdeen, and his players had nicknamed him Furious Fergie.
I'd like to see a Furious Fergie versus Rocky match or something. But yeah, this is early hairdryer treatment time, isn't it? We're seeing what would shape him in the future. And apparently one of the former players, John Hewitt, was actually fined because he overtook Ferguson on a public road.
another example of Fergie losing his temper to a point as he kicked a tea urn at the players at halftime after a poor first half.
Tea urn, like now you think like David Beckham got it lucky with a boot to the head, didn't he? Like it could have been like hot smouldering tea thrown over it. But for this season, success is reserved for the league only. In the Cups, they reached the Scottish Cup semi-final, losing to Rangers, ouch, again. And lost the League Cup final after a replay against Dundee United, a new firm derby final. That match actually ended 0-0. But then the replay was 3-0 to Dundee, and it was Dundee's first ever major honour.
So this is what we mean by this was the biggest high-profile new firm tie, and unfortunately Dundee United got the better of the Dons.
Yeah, and Fergie would actually take blame for that defeat, saying he should have made changes to his team for the replay. But I think he's been a bit harsh on himself there. I think all in all, this is a crazy, incredible season for someone in like their fourth year of management and only second year at Aberdeen.
To think coming into this season, they're being hard on themselves because they've won the league. And prior to that, they'd only won one league title in the history. It's incredibly harsh from Sir Alex, in my opinion. But those are the standards he set up in the north of Scotland.
Unlike the title-winning year of last season when they got off to a very bad start, they make a fantastic start to the 80-81 season. Only actually lost one game out of their first 22. But it's sort of the opposite thing that happened to the season before. And then sort of too many draws and a succession of losses towards the end of the season allowed Celtic to reclaim the title.
As a result of their title-winning campaign in the previous season, Aberdeen, however, did play in their first ever European Cup campaign. They would defeat Austrian champions Austria Memphis, but then they would lose 5-0 on aggregate to Liverpool.
Yeah, a Liverpool team featuring the likes of Ray Clements, Phil Thompson, Alan Hansen, Kenny Dalglish, Sammy Lee and Souness.
So maybe this was like the first needle in there about how Ferguson wanted to take Liverpool down off their perch when he joined Manchester United.
The domestic cups would also prove a frustrating challenge, and they lost in the quarterfinal of the League Cup to Dundee and were knocked out of the Scottish Cup in the fourth round by Morton. A marginal silver lining is adding another Driver Cup to the cabinet.
Ferguson would get one over his former team in St Mirren with a 2-1 win in the final. Ferguson's first substitute, Steve Cowell, would win it with a blistering left foot drive from 20 yards out.
And Steve Cowell actually came from St Mirren with Fergie as well, scoring against his ex-team.
The Driver Cup won't go down in history as like a glorious competition that's in the record books forever and ever. However, it would prove to be Ferguson's first silverware that he would achieve at Hampden.
Even though the league championship was the one the year before, the Driver Cup almost acts as like a catalyst to prove their mental strength and win trophies at Hampden. Like, it's their first experience of winning something there. The trophies seriously did fly after that.
The team continued their success with a Scottish Cup win in 1982. They claimed the trophy for the first time since 1970, back when Derek Cooktime Mackay won it. Aberdeen won 4-1 after extra time with goals from McGee, Strachan and Cooper. This also marked the first occasion a team outside of the old firm had won the cup for over 10 years, the last time being Aberdeen.
They really did go crazy in extra time. So Matt McGee's goal came on the 93rd minute, Gordon Strachan's came on the 103rd, and Neil Cooper's came on the 110th minute. Rangers have took them to extra time, and then Aberdeen just absolutely unleashed on them.
Shortly after this final, Ferguson was offered the manager job at Wolves, and it's kind of amazing to us to think that it took this long for a team either south of the border or the top two in Scotland, or even Europe for that matter, to even try and pinch Sir Alex from Aberdeen.
Yeah, and I love what he says after Wolves' approach. He turned it down because he said the Wolves are in a great position, but also his ambitions at Aberdeen were not even half fulfilled, which is very bold, but he seriously backs it up.
In the following season, which was their club's 80th year of existence, he would lead them to even greater success. After winning the Scottish Cup in 1982, Aberdeen qualified for the European Cup Winners' Cup.
After a large preliminary round victory over Sion of Switzerland, 11-1 on aggregate, Aberdeen then knocked out Dinamo Tirana of Albania, 1-0 on aggregate, Lech Poznan of Poland, 3-0 on aggregate, to set up a quarter-final tie with a little team from Bavaria, Bayern Munich.
They would survive in Munich, not conceding any goals and taking a 0-0 draw back to Pittodrie. However, Aberdeen fell behind early at home in the second leg, before Neil Simpson equalised to make it 1-1.
And another goal for Bayern Munich seemed to put the game beyond Aberdeen, but two quick goals in the last 20 minutes from McLeish and substitute John Hewitt gave the Dons an incredible 3-2 victory. And John Hewitt, what a super sub, in actually going to score an even more important substitute goal. But we'll speak about that soon.
As the final whistle went, the commentator proclaimed, "Well, that scoreline is quite impossible to believe. Aberdeen have quite possibly won their greatest ever victory." And oh no, it only gets better from here as well.
In the semi-finals, they would face off against Belgian team Waterschei, who were from Genk, and they were beaten 5-2 over two legs, putting Aberdeen to the final. Side little thing on Waterschei of Genk, which you maybe not heard of, and they merged with one of the greatest team names I've ever seen, KFC Winterslag, to form what we know today as KRC Genk. But yeah, Waterschei and KFC Winterslag.
It definitely caught our eyes reading that. We had to double check. KFC Waterslag, what a name. What a team name.
And they actually beat PSG in the previous round as well.
In the first leg, Aberdeen got off to a dream start as Eric Black opened the scoring with barely a minute and a half on the clock. 3 minutes later, Pedaudry erupted as the Dons scored again. Midfield dynamo Neil Simpson again finding the net with a fierce drive. Aberdeen's whirlwind start shattered the Belgian game plan and the crowd was right behind the Dons as they sensed a famous victory.
Peter Weir and Mark McGee's quick-fire double on the 67th and 69th minute completely killed it off, and amazing, amazing stuff. And Lars Gudmundsson would get a consolation goal for the visitors before Mark McGee gets his second to round up the scoring. Waterschei actually win the second leg 1-0, but obviously not enough to stop Aberdeen progress into a very historic final.
So the final was in none other than the Swedish port city of Gothenburg. And who was there ahead, Mark?
A team called Real Madrid.
Just that plucky little underdog team, Real Madrid, you might have heard of.
They come into it with some serious European pedigree, as you can imagine.
Even at this early stage of European competition, they were serious heavyweight contenders for any form of European competition.
But they hadn't actually reached a final since 1971, which was the European Cup Winners' Cup that lost to Chelsea. They had more success in the European Cup. They actually won it in its inaugural year in 1956 and, of course, retained it for the following four seasons. Their most recent European success had come in the 65-66 European Cup, where they defeated Partizan Belgrade.
However, on the other hand, it was the first European final for plucky little Aberdeen. Only two clubs from Scotland had previously won European trophies. No points for guessing who those other two teams were. Ferguson, speaking in the Never Giving documentary, says Real Madrid are the most successful club in the world. For a small club from a small town, this would make the fans' lives.
Yeah, and Aberdeen supporters travelled to Gothenburg in their droves, and some of them even getting in a fishing boat from Aberdeen to go there, and others sleeping on the streets around the stadiums, and there's estimated about 14, 15,000 Aberdonians made the trip to Sweden.
There's an amazing clip of a reporter speaking to the Dons fans. She says, "What are you going to do after the match?" And they proclaim, "Get drunk and celebrate." And she says, "What about if you lose?" And one just proudly says, "We'll still get drunk."
It really was the talk of the town. All the guys spending all their money going to watch Aberdeen on this amazing European journey all the way to the final. Apparently, like, you couldn't go in like a hairdresser's or any other shop without people overhearing women say, like, you know, "We're not going on holiday this year because he's off watching some game in Sweden."
Prior to this massive European final, we got an insight into how seriously Fergie would take the game. He spoke about how during his time at Aberdeen, he hadn't really had the chance to get to know his kids, and he'd missed out as he was never in the house, and he had left his wife to deal with all that type of stuff. However, he would turn around and say, "But I want you guys to do the same. We've got this big European game, and you need to shut them out and concentrate totally on Aberdeen Football Club." Brutal from Sir Alex.
I think just a born winner, isn't it? Like, win at all costs attitude. But as the team news came in, Aberdeen's Eric Black was declared fit to play this match after being injured over a month, a very important return to the team.
Fullback Stuart Kennedy was also named as a sub. Despite being injured in the semi-final and being completely unable to play, as a mark of respect from Ferguson, Kennedy was named on the bench and proved to be so severe that he never played again. But that's just a beautiful touch.
Yeah, and I think that's a really nice touch. It really mirrors, like, the stories you hear from players he had at Manchester United, like young lads who didn't even make it through the team, who just said, like, that kind of stuff is just a class act.
And on the day of the match, the pitch was covered by a tarpaulin and ordered to protect it from the rain. The referees made an inspection of the pitch prior to kickoff and determined that the surface was just about fit to play upon.
You'd think these weather conditions would suit Aberdeen more than Real Madrid, you'd imagine. But as the match kicked off, Aberdeen goes straight on the attack. Madrid's goalkeeper, Agustin, misdirected a goal kick. Strachan breaks away from his marker, controls and lobbed the forward to Eric Black, who hits a 20-yard volley towards the goal. It gets saved, onto the bar, Aberdeen have a corner. Strachan takes the corner, ball deflects off McLeish's head, and Eric Black's there, pounces on the ball, sends it in, Aberdeen 1-0 up. Like, wow.
A dream start for the Dons. The conditions on the pitch continued to get worse, which particularly resulted in Madrid's comeback, which you wouldn't have thought. However, McLeish passed the ball back to the goalkeeper, Jim Leighton, but it became stuck in the mud partway in the penalty area. Leighton rushed out to the goal line to claim the ball but took down the Madrid striker. A penalty was obviously awarded and Real's captain Juanito scored the penalty to put Madrid level.
When I first read the quote from McLeish where it says the weather deteriorated and this partially resulted in Madrid's comeback, I was thinking, you know, it's the same weather for both teams, you can't use that. And then you know, you see like the ball just stops in a big pile of mud, so yes, very unfortunate. But for the second half, teams are equally matched and send the game to extra time.
The winning goal would come in the 112th minute. Mark McGee took the ball down on the left wing. He crossed it towards super sub John Hewitt, as we've already mentioned, threw himself into the path with a diving header and connected with it to put Aberdeen ahead.
Yeah, so he's come on a sub and scored in the buy-in game and now the final, which is just brilliant. He pulls himself out of the thick mud and goes running off to the fans.
The second tier of the Swedish stadium, full of the Dons fans, is going absolutely mental. Aberdeen became only the third Scottish team to win any sort of European trophy and is arguably a greater achievement than anything he ever followed up at Manchester United.
I mean, you could easily retire at this point of like what he's done so far to then know that he goes on and wins like God knows how many Premier League titles, Champions League, like, it's crazy.
Ferguson stated after the game he had done something finally worthwhile with his life.
There's a great quote from Real legend Alfredo Di Stefano after the game, and he said, you know, the better teams won, and Aberdeen have what money can't buy, a soul and a team spirit built on family tradition, which is a very nice quote.
Simpson, Weir and Rugvi are all in there for Aberdeen, and McLeish has come up late, and the goal is there! And it's given by Black. Aberdeen ahead inside 7 minutes. That's a good ball from Peter Weir. And now Aberdeen with McGee making the break. And Hewitt waiting in the middle. Oh! Hewitt!
So you would think with this European triumph in the forefront of all these fans and all the players, you would think it's time for them to settle off for the summer break and enjoy their winnings. However, no, no, no. Just 10 days later, Aberdeen travelled to Hampden for the Scottish Cup final against none other than Rangers.
Yeah, no time for any rest at all there, is there? Aberdeen would actually win the match 1-0. Eric Black scoring an extra time goal, and the amount of minutes these players are putting, like every game seems to go to extra time as well, so they must be absolutely knackered. But yeah, helps them to their second trophy this season, so they've got two trophies, third place in the league, just wow, what a season. And talk about goals as well, you've got Matt McGee on 27, Strachan gets 20 from midfield, Eric Black 19, six players altogether in double figures.
Fergie had built upon the momentum started with Ali McLeod and the smart signings from Billy McNeil to cap off a tremendous season for all the Dons. Following their triumphant season, Alex Ferguson received a host of letters from players, managers from Scotland and England congratulating him and Aberdeen on their success. Most notably, one came from Bob Paisley, who at that time was manager of Liverpool, stating, "Congratulations, you've done us proud." A little bit of foreshadowing there for what would come during the 90s.
Yeah, and you'd be forgiven for thinking that 82-83 season would be seriously hard to top. How do you better that? But Fergie had different ideas for the 83-84 season. Spoiler alert, but they would compete in five competitions over the course of the season, winning three of them and reaching the semi-finals in the other two. So we've got Scottish Premier Division, first place. Scottish Cup, winners. Scottish League Cup, semi-final. UEFA Cup Winners' Cup, semi-final. UEFA Super Cup, winners. Another European trophy.
Aberdeen won their third Scottish League Championship, beating Celtic by 7 points and only conceding 21 goals all season. As well as that, they also retained the Scottish Cup for the third straight year. Aberdeen beat Rangers 1-0 after extra time in the Scottish Cup final, thanks to a 116th minute winner from Eric Black. That man again. Fergie's post-match was ruthless as ever, however. While the fans cheered and celebrated their players on the pitch, a TV reporter went quickly to interview the winning manager. I'm literally going to read this verbatim because there's no way to do it justice. The reporter asked Sir Alex, "Many congratulations for winning the Scottish Cup for the third time, but it was close." Fergie turns around and says, "We're the luckiest team in the world. We were a disgrace of a performance. Miller and McLeish have won the cup for Aberdeen. Miller and McLeish played Rangers by themselves. A disgrace of a performance. I don't care about winning cups. It doesn't matter. Our standards have been set a long time ago. I'm not going to accept that of any Aberdeen team. There's no way to take glory from that." At that point, the reporter timidly just asks, "Can you give a reason for why the disappointing performance then?" And he just turns around and say, "Couldn't they? If I could open up their minds, you'd be able to find it out yourself." So as brutal as ever from Sir Alex.
Very brutal, very high standards, obviously. Never wanted them to slip, even though, you know, they've had another ridiculous season.
Fergie speaks about this in the most recent Never Give In documentary and says, "I don't know why I even did it. I guess I wanted this to be the moment we set ourselves as the best team Scotland had ever had. Not just the best team in Scotland, ever. All time. The GOAT, however you want to say it, the best of all time."
You're going about it the right way, winning European trophies. So the European Super Cup. And this was a two-legged match contested between the European Cup champions, at this point, Hamburg, and the European Cup Winners' Cup, Aberdeen. And the match was 0-0 in the first leg at the Volkspark Stadion in Hamburg. And in the second leg at Pittodrie, Aberdeen added their second European trophy with a 2-0 victory.
Goals would come from Mark McGee and Neil Simpson. Thus, Aberdeen became the first Scottish team to win the UEFA Super Cup and the only Scottish team to win a European trophy at their home ground. However, they couldn't repeat their Cup Winners' Cup exploits of the previous season as they would lose 2-0 to Porto on aggregate in the semi-final. So still making a good old effort off at it and doing a European run.
Yeah, I think there's no shame in getting to the semi-final again. All that in itself is also a great achievement. So obviously, by this point, clubs have started to sit up and look at like what this guy's achieved. I think he's got the attention of England and Europe, and even the Queen, who named him in her New Year's honours list.
Offers came in from Arsenal and as well as Rangers, who of course Sir Alex played for in his playing career. So I'm astounded that they didn't think, well, there's this lad who used to play for us and he's doing amazing things at Aberdeen. We'll pinch him off a rival, quiet them down, and we'll get all this beautiful success. Don't know what they were thinking, personally.
Yeah, and he'd keep adding trophies to the cabinet, and they did retain the league title in the 84-85 season, powered by their new signing up front, Frank McDougall. He would actually score 24 goals in his debut season at Pittodrie, and he'd join from St Mirren for a fee of just £100,000. 22 league goals, 24 in all competitions, and the top goal scorer in the SPL. Including a hat-trick as Aberdeen clinched the title with a 3-0 win at Hearts.
Aberdeen would win the top flight with a record points haul of 59 from a possible 72.
And they absolutely destroyed the league. 89 goals scored, only 26 conceded in 36 games, only losing 4 games. Goal difference of plus 63. And you've got to feel sorry for Morton at the bottom there. They conceded 100 goals. The goal difference of minus 71.
It also marked the third consecutive year a team other than Celtic or Rangers had won the Scottish title, the only time this has ever happened, with Dundee winning one and Aberdeen winning two. But as of 2021, this is the last season that a team other than the Old Firm has won the top level of Scottish football.
So a tremendous performance from Aberdeen to come back after trailing from Roy Aiken's penalty goal 5 minutes from half-time. And then it was their captain, Willie Miller, who gave an inspired defensive performance and who eventually had the equalising goal which guarantees the league championship for Aberdeen for the second time in succession and the third time in 6 years.
So moving on to the next season, in 1985-86, Aberdeen would win both domestic trophies but would only finish fourth in the league. But Ferguson had been appointed actually to the club's board of directors in early 1986. But in April, he told chairman Dick Donald that he intended to leave that summer. I love the fact he's been appointed to the club of directors. This is proper football manager, completed it, mate. Like,
in typical football manager style as well, he would join the Scottish national team as part of the coaching staff too. This was during the qualifying stages for the 1986 World Cup, but manager Jock Stein unfortunately collapsed and passed away in the September of 1985. This happened at the end of the game in which Scotland qualified from their group for a playoff against Australia and therefore also the tournament in the summer.
Ferguson actually agreed to take over the national team against the Australians, and then when they won that game, subsequently at the World Cup as well. Very football manager. So to allow him to fulfil his international duties, he appointed Archie Knox as his co-manager at Aberdeen. However, after Scotland failed to progress past the group stage of the World Cup, he stepped down as national team manager. Around this time, obviously, we spoke about that interest once again. Tottenham sniffing around, wanted him to take over from Peter Shreeves. He rejected this and the job went to Luton Town's David Pleat instead.
There was also an offer for Ferguson to replace Don Howe as Arsenal manager, but he rejected this offer as well, and fellow Scot George Graham took the post instead. Over the summer, there was some speculation, even some coming from him being considered for the next job at Liverpool after the retirement of Joe Fagan was announced. However, this was quickly resolved by Kenny Dalglish, the Liverpool striker. Oh, what could have been?
That feels like such a glitch in the matrix, isn't it? Like, all the football we've grown up at, like Manchester United being like this dominant force, and imagine if that didn't happen. Like, imagine if he went to Liverpool and just carried on their domination.
Or what if it just never worked out for Ferguson? How different the top flight of England and European football could have been?
Completely changes the landscape of football. Like, I'm just trying to imagine it now, and just everything is different.
Who else would have been Man United manager? If Fergie didn't succeed, who would have then come in at Liverpool? You would have had to have thought who would have like got into spats with him about referees and all that type of stuff as well. It just changes the story of football forever.
And also like the effect he had on young players' career. Obviously, well documented, all like the class of 92 players. Like, what would have happened? How would it have worked? Would they have got the opportunity? Even like Cristiano Ronaldo, like...
We would have never seen all of those hairstyles from David Beckham, maybe.
Maybe Beckham would have ended up staying at Preston and living out his life in like second or third division or something.
However, coming back to reality, there was speculation that he would take over the role at Manchester United from Ron Atkinson. They'd slumped to fourth after a 10-match winning start of the season. Although Ferguson remained at Aberdeen over the summer, he did eventually join Manchester United when Atkinson was sacked in November of 1986.
Yeah, and Ron Atkinson has even said, like, later on, if he was the chairman, he would have fired him and fired himself and taken Ferguson, which I think it sort of is a no-brainer when you look at his track record.
So also another funny perspective looking back. Can you name, Mark, the three teams that were below Manchester United when Fergie took over? Because these names are just, you wouldn't expect.
I'm going to say Man City.
Yes, actually, their cross-city rivals were below them, but also Chelsea and Newcastle United, teams that Ferguson with Manchester United would battle with regularly. It's weird to think of these Chelsea and Manchester City, these money-rich clubs who are now fighting for European titles and titles in the Premier League, being possibly relegation candidates. It seems like another world.
Yeah, not much has changed for Newcastle, sadly. Ferguson, when he leaves Aberdeen, the silverware he's racked up at this point is just crazy. Like, I'm just going to quickly just recap what this guy won at Aberdeen. So you've got Scottish Premier Divisions, he won three, plus twice finished second place. Scottish Cup, he won four, plus one runners-up. Scottish League Cup, he won one, runners-up three times. The Drybra Cup, of course. European Cup Winners' Cup and a European Super Cup. Crazy hot. Like, most managers will not achieve this in their full career, like, no chance, and he's done this at the early point before he does even more ridiculous stuff
in his third job in managerial career.
It's absolutely insane. Now we've like properly looked into it, I appreciate it even more, and I think arguably, even though he does amazing stuff at United, like, this stuff is just off the scale. The European Cup Winners' Cup with Aberdeen is like well up there. You know, people going about like the 99 Man United treble and stuff, but like, that is amazing. I think
literally since Ferguson left Aberdeen, no one has taken the fight to the old firm.
I think that says it all, the fact since like Aberdeen won that last league title, no one else has ever beaten Celtic or Rangers.
Well, we all know what happened next in his career, and if we would need another hour to list all the other achievements and titles he won at Manchester United, it personally hurts me a little bit, so I don't want to talk about it too much. However, one thing we did note, when he finished his Manchester United career, he finished on a very, very satisfying 1,500 games managed for Manchester United.
That really pleases me. Definitely.
And the Aberdeen supporters waiting to greet Willie Miller as he walks forward. Dr. Franchi about to hand over the trophy. Carlos Santillana, the beaten Real Madrid captain, looks on as Willie Miller holds aloft the European Cup Winners' Cup, backed by that squad of players which really didn't have a weakness tonight. Some tremendous individual performances, one of them by Neil Simpson holding a trophy now.
So as the Ferguson era comes to a close, it's the perfect time to sort of round out part one of our Aberdeen episode.
In our upcoming next part, we have the return of a legend, the club's first and only foreign manager, and European ties against some of Europe's elite, and of course, looking ahead to the future for Aberdeen Football Club.
In the meantime, I hope you've enjoyed this listen, and get yourselves on social media, because to promote our second part, we're going to be giving away another shirt, a new Aberdeen shirt for this season. So get yourselves retweeting, liking, following and sharing with your family and friends to try and win that. And we'll see you again next time.
So as Mark has just mentioned there, make sure to share, as everything you do helps the podcast grow, helps with the algorithms and all that, especially on Apple Music. If you could rate 5 stars, that'll help us tremendously. And thank you very much. So apart from that, We've been the Journeyman Podcast here with Aberdeen. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
See you all next time for part two here at Pádraig.
See you next time.